Welcome to Classical Companion. I'm Diane Jones, and over the next weeks and months, I'll be chatting with artists and musicians throughout the region about the music they turn to in these challenging times. I'm so excited. Today, I am speaking with Maestro Lawrence Lowe from Symphoria. Larry, it's so good to have you chatting with us today.
Oh, I'm so happy to do this. It's great to talk to you, and the great program that you are doing for us.
I want to do a quick check-in with you. How are you and the musicians of Symphoria doing? Because it is certainly challenging.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of uncertainty. You know, we have some canceled concerts, and we're still, you know, looking forward to the future as if, you know, everything is going to go as planned, including, you know, all of the planning that we've already done for next season and even beyond that. So we're always in motion. We're always thinking about what's happening now and in the future. So in that respect, you know, we're doing what we always do, but in the sense of actually performing, you know, it's very difficult for us to not be on that stage. But of course, it's the right thing for us to be doing, and we're just going to sit tight and hope for the best.
And one of the ways we can still kind of commune with each other is through music. You sent me a list of a bunch of your favorite music, and I absolutely love it. Why don't you talk to us a little bit about some of these pieces? The first one on your list is Copland's Appalachian Spring. Talk to us about this.
This is one of the first pieces I conducted as a student. There's a 13-instrument version of Appalachian or Appalachian, depending on where you come from. Appalachian Spring. And the 13-instrument version is one that conducting students love to put together because they can just get their strings and clarinet and bassoon and flute and piano, put them together and put this small ensemble together and play some of the most beautiful music. There are a lot of conducting challenges within the piece, which is why a lot of conductors gravitate towards it early in their careers. But as far as listening to it, it just has everything. It has the most peaceful opening and closing. It has a narrative that Copland himself actually didn't think of each thing having some kind of dramatization. He just wrote this ballet for Martha Graham. And a lot of the narrative came from her. In fact, even the title came from her. So when you listen to it, you can think of it as just pure, beautiful notes, and you can also think of a scene in Appalachia where you have a couple and their house and the fields and the pasture coming through the town. I mean, there's all sorts of things that come to mind, but in the end, it is just beautiful, peaceful music and something I love listening to during times of stress.
Well, this is a big part of this. Let's take a quick listen to at least some of Appalachian Spring, music of Aaron Copland. I love that full orchestral version. It is so different from the smaller version. And as you say, it has its different challenges for conducting students.
Oh, for sure.
Now, this is really interesting. And I love these lists that I'm getting from various people. You and Cornelia Orth from Cayuga Chamber both have one of the same pieces on your list, and that's Beethoven's 7th Symphony. So I'm curious what it is that draws you in about the 7th Symphony. What speaks to you?
Yeah, I love that. I love that she picked that. It's just one of these. It's one of these symphonies that has such an incredibly, startlingly original opening with that, you know, giant full orchestra A major chord, and then just basically the oboe taking the line. And it just uses the orchestra in such a dramatically original way. Some of his most recognizable music is in the symphony. That second movement is a, you know, one of the most beautiful processionals, which is basically a processional tempo. And he basically writes a theme and variations on that throughout that movement. And it's some of the most beautiful and somber music among his symphonic movements. And then the way that it ends is just absolutely rollicking joy. And I love that feeling that you get from living through some turmoil. You know, that second movement has a little bit of an emotional turmoil. The third movement has a lot of levity. And then the final movement has a kind of triumphant gallop. And the best symphonies, the best music has tension and release throughout the arc, not just on the micro level, but on the macro level. And in this case, it's just the perfect sequence of events that leads you to that joy at the end.
Let's take a listen. I know we've heard a little bit of Beethoven's Seventh, but you can never get too much Beethoven. Let's hear a little more from Beethoven's Seventh Symphony. It is such a trip with Beethoven. He takes you to the very highest highs and the lowest lows in I think all the music that he writes, really.
Absolutely. It's the human condition. And he is someone who suffered a lot in his personal life. And music was something that he just could not suppress in him, even with all of his challenges with his deafness, his solitude. And this symphony and all of his symphonies are just a testament to the human spirit.
From Beethoven, now you've, and we're just going down this list because it is a beautiful list in fantastic order. We're going to Rachmaninoff's symphonic dances, and specifically the third movement of the symphonic dances. What is it about this piece that catches you by the heart?
Well, this is his final symphonic work, as far as, you know, he wrote his symphonies and then he wrote the symphonic dances and at the end of his life. And it's a very concise three movement work. So the third movement is the finale. It is not structured like a typical four movement symphony. And each movement is exploring different kinds of dances. And the third movement is Midnight. So there used to be a subtitle. It's not there anymore, but we know that he was thinking of midnight for this. You hear the chimes chiming in midnight. You hear the dies irae coming in towards the end, which is the day of wrath, day of fury. And that is something that he was very attracted to, the idea of fate and the dies irae, and that slips into many of his pieces. And he's not the only composer who did this, but he did it a lot, and I think this is one of the most effective places where he did it in this symphonic dances. So, you know, this isn't exactly a calm piece. I was thinking afterwards, after I wrote this list, that there's quite a bit of angst, but I guess that's how I feel right now. So this is something that expresses a little bit of my own, you know, my own personal feelings currently. So it is satisfying and joyful at the end, but it's all kind of shrouded in this macabre texture with that Dies Irae theme woven in.
This is the third movement from Rachmaninoff's Symphonic Dances, Midnight. This brings up an interesting point about music to carry us through challenging times, because it's not, as you say, this is a movement full of angst. And do you think sometimes that's a good thing for us, is to pull that angst from our music rather than just trying to hide it, I guess, with something else, with something lighter?
Oh, I mean, for me, music has to have tension and release. If you have just the, beautiful themes and over and over again, nothing gets Pachelbel's canon. But that's the sort of thing where it's a incredibly beautiful, simple work, which never really has the kind of tension in where you can, I think, get drawn in a certain way. I don't know if that's the best example, but for me, life has both. And when you come to listen to a concert, or when you're listening to music, it has to have some kind of journey. And so the Rachmaninoff, I think, from beginning to end, is great. Even within this third movement, towards before we get to that final coda, there is that beautiful, beautiful soaring theme that what almost is like a love theme. And then in a very unsuspecting way, he turns back to the Dies Irae at the very end. And it just shows all the different facets of life.
Very much a reflection of our times right now. Now we've got music of Mahler. You've chosen a couple of works of Mahler to include on your list. Talk to us about these.
So these are both symphonies that the orchestra has played within the within its birth as Symphoria. I conducted the Mahler first, and David LaBelle conducted the Mahler fifth. And so I picked the finale from the first, and I picked the Adagietto from the fifth symphony, and for different reasons. So the finale of Mahler I begins with basically a lightning strike. And thunder and a storm, and it is incredibly agitated right from the beginning. But at the end of this piece, at the end of the finale, the 8+ assistants, so 9 French horns, stand up in triumph, playing this incredible, what almost sounds like the bells at the town center, and everyone is coming down to the town because the bells are ringing, and everyone in the orchestra is just in absolute triumph and jubilation. And this first symphony finale takes us through that journey from storm to triumph. And I love listening to this. It's a very satisfying piece musically. It has so much variety, and really, it was his first attempt at writing a symphony, and it is one of his most popular. So I love that first symphony. And then the fifth, should I talk about the fifth?
Yeah, let's talk about the fifth.
So the fifth symphony contains this one movement that is sometimes extracted that's written for harp and strings, and it's the Adagietto from the fifth symphony. And it is basically a love letter to Alma, his wife. And when you listen to this music, it has density within this very small orchestration of just using the strings and the harp. But at the same time, the harmonies that he explores and the melodies that he writes for every corner of the string section and the harp shows how many levels of depth you can get in this limited orchestration. It's one of his most beautiful pieces that among his symphonies, which is why it's very often performed as a standalone work. And hopefully we'll get to perform it again soon.
Well, a little more of Maestro Lawrence Lowe's favorites, the finale from Mahler's Symphony 1 and the Adagietto from the Fifth Symphony. Let's take a listen. Well, now you're moving us on to something very romantic.
Yeah, I picked the Tchaikovsky Romeo and Juliet. Honestly, the reason that I picked this piece is that it was one of the first, you know, along with the Copland Appalachian Spring, the Tchaikovsky Romeo and Juliet was one of the first pieces I conducted in performance as a student while I was at Yale. So because of that, it has a sentimental meaning to me. So whenever I listen to it, it just takes me to the beginning of my exploration of conducting as a profession. The piece itself is, you know, his fantasy overture, and it just takes general themes from the story of Romeo and Juliet. It has a love theme, it has a sword fight, it has the coda at the very end, and it's sort of like Friar Lawrence saying, once upon a time there was this tragedy, and etc. And so when I listen to this music, it takes me to that innocence of the early studies of conducting, not knowing what I was going to get myself into. And so I think for me, it has a personal sentimental reason. But for a lot of people, when they listen to this, it's just, you know, some of his most beautiful melodic writing. And the love theme in particular is one of the most famous. It's used in movies and TV. Anytime you want to show love, almost in a stereotypical way, it never fails to convey that by using this love theme.
Let's take a listen to Romeo and Juliet from Tchaikovsky, the Fantasy Overture.
Thank you.
You were saying that this piece takes you back to your early days of conducting, and I think that has a lot to do with what music does to carry us through sometimes, is that context, don't you think?
Oh, for sure. I know that if you just take film music in general, or the effect that music in film has on the viewer, if you were to watch E.T., which is the perfect example to me, just because it's sort of like one of the movies that made such a huge impression on me as a young person. If you were to just play a little bit of those themes, it takes you back to those moments, and you can't really separate them. They are absolutely tied together. And so for me, this Romeo and Juliet fantasy overture takes me back to that time, has a immediate subconscious almost level of connection to my soul. And that's one of the most amazing things about music.
Well, next up, we've gone from an early symphony of Mahler. Now we've got the Shostakovich 10, second movement. Talk to us about that work.
If we take the Shostakovich symphonies, the wide variety of writing that he has this texture that he uses in some of his scherzo dance type movements that he uses in the second movement with these heavy offbeats. And this is a very concise, brutal statement. The 10th Symphony, this second movement is a portrait of Stalin. And when you listen to it, it should sound brutal. It should have this aggressive quality to it. It is propulsive to the end. It's very short and dense. And I just, it's just one of those symphonic movements for me that if I have a lot of energy that I need to express through listening, I love to put this on and just hear the orchestra make this incredible statement using Shostakovich's very unique texture.
Let's take a listen to the second movement from the Shostakovich Symphony No. 10. You have a Requiem up next for us. Tell us what brought this to mind.
Yeah, so I picked the Brahms Requiem. Some people may know that I tend to gravitate towards Brahms in programming. I've always managed to talk the artistic committee of Symphoria into programming Brahms pretty much every year. And the Requiem we performed several years ago. It's just one of those requiems that stands out among many as being very unique, because Brahms didn't use the Roman Catholic, the Latin text. He was trying to speak to the people so that the listening audience, in his case, German-speaking audience, would hear this text and it would speak to them, and it was a requiem for the living. And so he picked just incredibly beautiful texts, and it's a seven movement, extremely unique requiem. And if we wanted to pick one movement from this, I would go to the finale, the seventh movement, which is just this incredibly rising, beautiful, long lines in the chorus. The orchestra is just playing these beautiful, propulsive offbeats in the strings, and it's just the most uplifting and encouraging finale. When I conduct this music, it's really hard for me to stay emotionally in check because I just get so swept away. By the time you get to this last movement, you feel comfort. You feel a sense of sadness, but you also feel a lot of hope. So I hope that our listeners will get to hear that in this last movement.
Well, let's get swept away in the finale of the Brahms German Requiem. Now, this work, I have to call you out on this because I understand you and your family had a slight disagreement, which you posted online, about Brahms symphonies. You know, you're stuck at home now and you're fighting with your family over Brahms.
Well, I mean, it was one of those conversations where, you know, the family, some people in this family, in my family, have very strong opinion about which of these Brahms symphonies they like the most. And it's kind of funny that we have those kinds of discussions. For me, you know, honestly, I love all the Brahms symphonies. I just have a special feeling about this third symphony, which is the one that I picked for this list. But my wife, Jen, she just loves the fourth, and the fourth is great. We love the Fourth Symphony. It's his last symphony. It has everything in it. It has this incredibly original finale. And my son Charlie, he has learned a lot of orchestral excerpts from the First Symphony, and so he's done a lot of listening with that one. And I think that for him, you know, he has listened to all of them, but he really knows as a violinist this First Symphony. So I think that he's a little biased. You know, I need to indoctrinate him on what makes this third symphony so great. And if we just take the last movement from this, it is unique among his four symphonies in that it ends very quietly, and so it doesn't have this feeling of like, here's the end, you know, and then the audience just jumps to their feet. Usually the audience is kind of transcendent at the end. There's this feeling of transcendence. So what I love in this finale is, and you can guess, there's a theme to the way that I think about music, but the harmonic tension, and this is something that's very characteristic of the music of Brahms. He just has a way of picking the perfect voicing and perfect harmony where you'll have a suspension and release and suspension and release. Every chord has some vertical and horizontal, but really if you were to just take a harmonic slice, and you know this as a composer, that there is so much that we can find in each cross section of this work. And what makes it so miraculous is the way that he draws our ear in to hear and feel this tension, and then to hear the way that he resolves each line. Not to put, you know, so much description on it, but if you were to just follow one line through this entire symphony, you will find that line has such an exciting route from beginning to end.
Well, let's take a bit of a listen to Brahms' Third Symphony.
Thank you.
So I guess it means you win the argument since you get to go on the radio and declare this as your favorite. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. But, you know, there's this saying that conductors have, which is that, you know, what's your favorite Brahms symphony? It's the one that you're about to conduct. And it's always that. It's always that way. Whatever Brahms has put in front of us, it is always our favorite piece.
Absolutely. Well, you've got two choices now from Stravinsky. Talk to us about these works.
Yeah, The Rite of Spring and Petrushka, these are both among his early ballets that he wrote. And I love both of them for different reasons. Maybe we'll go to Petrushka.
Mm-hmm.
So for Petrushka, he is basically telling the story of this this puppet, Petrushka, who's in love with this princess and then is a Moor. And the Moor is also interested in the princess. And Petrushka feels solitude. And at the end, it ends very tragically, and there's this puppeteer slash magician who's kind of behind the scenes and making these puppets come to life. And it turns out that these puppets kind of have a soul. And so it is, you know, kind of creepy, but at the same time, from a musical standpoint, I just love this music, especially the early version of Petrushka, which is from 1911. Just the way that he uses the orchestra. You know, he's a Russian composer. He's writing for a ballet production in Paris with a Russian ballet company. And this is just the perfect blend of, you know, his Russian roots and the direction of French orchestration during this time. And it is full and inventive and beautiful and ravishing. And I just love it. It's just it's a miracle to listen to this music.
Let's listen to a little of that miracle, Petrushka, from Igor Stravinsky. Well, and then we have Stravinsky's other well-known ballet, The Rite of Spring.
Right, The Rite of Spring, which we performed recently. It is also famous, like Petrushka, in that, you know, it was one of his ballet works from the beginning of the 20th century. But Rite of Spring, at the time, and this is just one of those stories that surrounds this work, was not as well received as it is now. It was so different and so unexpected that the audience kind of turned against the production. But now when we hear this music, it shows the virtuosity of an orchestra so well. I just watched a performance online of Simon Rattle conducting this with London Symphony on a live stream, and it was just so amazing to watch the orchestra play this piece. It's so dense. There are a lot of famous parts in it for orchestras, as far as like conducting challenges of getting parts together. If we were to even just take the sacrificial dance at the very end of the work, the downbeats are nowhere to be seen. You know, we're just kind of the subdivision that an orchestra has to do independently and perfectly together has to be so precise, like clockwork, to make this piece work. And when we did it, we really pulled it off, and it was fun to watch Simon Rattle and the London Symphony do it recently. So if you were to play anything from this, I would say play that last part, because it just shows how a collective group of 100 musicians have to work together so precisely to pull off one of the most exciting finales by Igor Stravinsky.
Finale to the Rite of String, the Rite of String, there we go, the Finale to the Rite of Spring by Igor Stravinsky. And yes, it's wonderful to have seen Symphoria perform that as well. We are so lucky to have an ensemble like that right here in our own backyard. That finishes the original list that you sent me. And then you said, I have to add one more. What are you adding for us?
I know we had already talked about how much I love Brahms, and I was just thinking about the way I feel right now, and I felt like I wanted to add the second piano concerto of Brahms to this list. It is an unusual concerto in that there are four movements. It begins with just a single solo horn playing a theme that is followed by an elaboration by the piano, and then that peaceful theme continues in the French horn, followed by the piano again. And it's peaceful, it's calming, but then of course the music, because it's Brahms, has a lot of tension, especially the second movement has an incredible amount of tension. But then when you get to that third movement, which has a very famous cello solo in it, we return back to that peaceful feeling. And then by the time we get to the fourth movement, we are able to feel at peace and calm. And in it, and there's an arc again from beginning to end. And I remember being so obsessed with this piece, I would listen to it over and over again before I first conducted it. It was just one of those pieces I love to listen to from beginning to end, because I really feel like Brahms takes us on a journey. And by the time you get to the end of this journey, you really feel at peace and you feel a sense of calm. And for me, that's what I need most these days. It's easy to carry a lot of tension from everything that is happening. And sometimes to hear something that you just can't believe a human being can write this music, how beautiful it is to hear. A great performance of the Brahms Second Piano Concerto is a really beautiful and calming thing to go through.
Well, let's wrap up our conversation together with a listen to Brahms Piano Concerto Number 2, a little oasis of calm in this turbulent time. Well, Larry, I want to say thank you so much for sharing this music with us today and sharing how it moves you and how it speaks to you in these troubled times. Is there anything else you'd like to leave with us as we make our way through from day to day?
Just I hope everyone takes care, and we hope that everyone is doing okay. On behalf of the orchestra, we really miss performing for everyone, and we hope to be on that stage again as soon as it is safe to do so. And until then, we are with everyone and thinking of everyone, and we send everyone great thoughts and wishes.
That is this episode of Classical Companion. I'm Diane Jones. Once again, many, many thanks to Maestro Lawrence Lowe from Symphoria, Music Director of Symphoria, for spending some time with us today. Thank you so much, Larry.
Thank you.